He's really an accomplished educator and has, as he says, taught at every level of education that there is, even doing some postdoctorate work in Indiana. I really look forward to hearing from him, and I know you will. Before I sit down, let me tell you about the meetings that will be coming up in July. Mel will be with us to sign his books. I think he'll have some copies with him at that time. Joe Carter Denman is going to talk to us about his World War II experience. He was a squadron leader during World War II. I have tentatively set an appointment for my grandsons to go and talk to him. If you go in his office, you know that there's a plane up above his desk. And my grandsons put a motor on everything there is, you know, so they're really going to be excited to get to talk to him. Joe, we're going to have to ask him back for some other ones because his family really goes deep in this community. In August, Mel Johnson is going to have the program to himself. He's going to talk to us about the history of the Mormons, Church of Latter-day Saints in Angelina County. There was, in addition to the church that's here now, there was one at Shawnee, near Shawnee Prairie at one time earlier. And in doing some work out at Redtown, a call that we received, I discovered that according to this source, there was one out in the Cheeseland area at one time too, a much earlier date. So Mel is going to consolidate those together. This will be part of a larger program that I hope to do later on religious diversity, the growth of religious diversity in Angelina County, including Mr. Finley's work with Unitarians and other groups that have come along as well. Right now, I'm going to turn it over to Otis and let us tell him about his speech as I slowly turn black. Otis?
Thank you for that generous introduction. I'm going to shed my coat here. That's another symptom that I have turned black. And if you notice the letter, it said, as I slowly turn black. But that should be in past tense, as I slowly turn black. Because I think I wrote this little expose back in 1972, and at that time the metamorphosis had just about completed itself. I had written it somewhat earlier than that. It would have been most appropriate to use the term turn, because I was in the process of turning. And now you will note that a latter portion of this little expose has been updated just a bit from what it was in 1972. Now, back in 1969, I believe it was, I affiliated with a project that was funded by the federal government. The project was entitled Project Philema. And I'm sure we have a lot of Bible scholars in here. Project Philema was taken from the Book of Philema. It was based upon the Book of Philema, where, what was the name of the slave that ran away from Philema? Onesimus ran away from his slave owner and ended up in jail with Paul, I believe. And while he was in jail with Paul, Paul converted him to Christianity. And after Onesimus had been converted to Christianity, he was in somewhat of a dilemma. He didn't know whether he wanted to go back to his slave owner or whether he wanted to continue to exercise that great feeling of freedom. And I think Paul persuaded him to go back, and if I remember correctly, Paul either wrote Philema a letter or called him by telephone or used email or something. Anyhow, he got the message to Philema to accept Onesimus back, but not to accept him back as a slave, but to accept him back as a brother. And this is in essence what the Project Philema was attempting to do, was attempting to alleviate all of the problems associated with integration at that time. As you might recall, Lufkin was one of the last four school districts in the state of Texas to desegregate. I won't say to integrate, because they didn't really integrate they were forced to desegregate. And they were offering help in how do we somehow ameliorate these two races that have been so distant and apart for all of these generations and centuries, you might say. And how can we now learn to live harmoniously together? So in working in this project, I came up with little topics and tasks and speeches trying to somehow relate to the other world what it was like to live in a world of blackness. And in so doing, I find myself becoming even more black than I had been in the past. And I came up with this little talk that I'm going to give here just briefly. We should be here in about 5 minutes. I entitled it, As I Slowly Turn Black. Now, when I first heard the once popular hit tune by James Brown, I'm Black and I'm Proud. Now, I don't know whether any of you listened to it back in the days. I was somewhat miffed by that song at first and somewhat repulsed by it, because I looked into the mirror and I asked myself, proud? Proud of what? Now, at that time, it was difficult for me to see anything that the black man had to be proud of. For at that time, I was blind, and I was not black. I was blind because I was not aware of how the black man had helped not only shape America, but it helped to shape the entire world. And though the color was there, I was not black, because I didn't think black. And I wasn't particularly proud of the fact at that time that I had been born black. Now, there were two basic reasons why I had this attitude. One was a society that discriminated against her black sisters and brothers and hid, distorted, or even stole the contributions that blacks had made to this nation and to the world. And the other thing that caused me to have this kind of attitude was the insistence of a dominant culture that unless you were like it was, you were somehow inferior, inadequate, and virtually no good. Therefore, if you wanted to be looked upon with favor back in those days, and if you wanted to make it in that society, you had to emulate the dominant culture all the way from the way you talked to the way you combed your hair. And if you didn't stand half of a chance to make it, so to speak. So we as black people became so brainwashed that even to us, black was bad. Black was no good. And many of us did everything we could to get rid of that blackness. We read the description of our hair in the dictionary, and it was described as kinky, knotty, nappy, and the dominant society said, that's a bad hair. And we ourselves began teasing and poking fun at our own selves if we had hair like Kirk's. We said, that kinky, that knotty, that twirly hat, that's some bad stuff. And we did all we could to get rid of that bad hat. Now, we fellas, I wasn't quite old enough at the time, but for older fellas, would go down to the store and buy some Irish potato, some lye, some stiff grease, and I don't know exactly what the composition, but they'd mix it up and they'd smear it on the hair. And in about 30 or 40 minutes, that hair would begin to crinkle and curl and straighten, and then they would wash it out and comb that stuff back, and it was straight and wavy, and then they would say, I got some good hair. And we called it conking back in the day. Mm-hmm. And this is one I tried. They had some ointment they called black and white ointment.
the first half of the box was black, and the other half of the box was white. And the idea was, if you use this black and white on it, just watch yourself go through this metamorphosis. That old black skin you got, if you use it long enough, you keep washing and waxing, one day you'll look up and you'll be there in the white. I even spent, I don't know how much, my black and white on it, in order that my face, my skin, might be light. Now for the girl, or the women, there was this great invention called the straightening comb. Now we had that little metal comb that we would put in the fireplace or on the heater. Later on we got sophisticated. The beautician had little gas, what do they call them? Burners. You get those straightening combs, you can lay them on top of that little gas burner and heat that comb up and whip it through that hair, and after a while, the black ladies too had that beautiful straight hair. And they said, that's some good hair. Now this is the kind of mindset that we had been led to allow ourselves to get into. But one day, they said, check out the hair of the black man. That stuff, it can rain on it. It just sits there. It gets more stuff. That the wind can blow it. It just sits there. Now you notice the other race, comes the rain, the hair's all down over the face, down. It can't do anything with it. Look at that black hair. That black hair stomach, it just sits right there. I said, that's some good hair. That hair shall not be moved. So I began to make the transition from this black is bad, black is no good, until black is wonderful. And as I continued to ponder the question, I had truly not made the total metamorphosis yet, because again I would look into the mirror and I would see this black face. And I would reflect on this song, I'm black and I'm proud. And again I would ask the question, proud? Proud of what? Proud when you are cursed with a skin that a dominant culture tells you that it is the very epitome of evil. That black skin is the very epitome of gloom and doom. Long, long time ago, we as a people were assigned labels and cliches that suggested to us that the color of black is bad. It's no good. And to convince us of that, we came up with all of these old sayings and cliches and whatever. And like black cat, bad luck. All of the different coloration of cats in the world, black cats, bad luck. Even at my grandma, bless her heart, we would be going to church on Sunday mornings. A black cat crossed the trail. Oh my God, son, bad luck's coming. Bad luck's coming. Now if we was able to back up and go out around and get around that black cat, It was all right. But if that black cat took out across the road and we had to cross this trail, Lord, watch out for what's going to happen for the rest of the day. Black cat done cross the trail.
It's going to the left.
If you're especially going to the left. Now if you went to the right, it's not going to be so bad. It's going to have a little bad look, but if you went to the left, Lord, the folks might die. My mules might run. I don't know what's going to happen, Lord, but we're going to have some bad luck today. That's how they had brainwashed us. And the child in the family who caused all the heartaches and headaches, he was called the black sheep of the family. Don't want him to come around. Stay away from me, boy, you black sheep. And when you did so many bad things, you got on the bad list of people that I'm going to put you on the black list. When you could consider that Friday, when everything went wrong, said, this is Black Friday. Everything bad was associated with the color of black. How then could black kids and black folks avoid having this brain set, this mindset, I'm no good, I'm of little worth, because I'm black. And we tried to get away from that blackness. But somewhere along the way, somebody began to emphasize the positive aspects of the color black. And we were told at one time that the rarest flower in the world was a black orchid. And at one time, the favorite story of all children back in the 1950s or 60s was Black Beauty, of this black horse, this black stallion. And we were saying that the most satisfying condition of the budget is when we can say, it's in the black. I got some money in my pocket, I can pay all the bills. Pay my house, my car note. Box full of groceries. Still got a little money in my pocket. It's in the black. I'm in good shape. And when a farmer wants to rain, his most welcome sight is black cloud blowing up over the horizon. And I'm saying that the most expensive pearl, I'm not sure if that's paste, was a black pearl. Because you very seldom find a black pearl, I'm told. And once you come up on a black pearl, you have a fortune. And for the third time, I stared into the mirror and I asked myself, proud? Proud of what? Proud when you come from a race that has contributed little or nothing to the building and shaping of America, and has contributed little or nothing to the building and shaping of the world? Proud of what? We had been told by the white man that we were mere savages in Africa, and we were captured like cattle, loaded on ships and brought over here to the land of opportunity, to the land of plenty. We should be proud of the fact that we have been rescued from the wilds of Africa. That's what we were told. Because we were told that everybody in Africa was savages, unlearned, unschooled. Then one day, somebody suggested to me that I read books of true history. And as I read books of true history, we discovered that thousands of years before that was the United States of America, there were black nations in Africa living at the very highest level of civilization. We were never told that. Songhai, Ghana, Malay, all these nations were dealing with nations of the world at the highest level of intelligence, highest level of commerce for that day. And I began to take pride in my African heritage as I slowly turned black. Contrary to popular belief, the first black man to set foot on American soil was not a slave, but an explorer. Pedro Alonso Nino, if you speak Spanish, please don't question the pronunciation of that. He was a navigator on one of the ships that sailed to the New World under the command of Christopher Columbus in 1492. When Balboa discovered the Pacific Ocean in 1513, 30 black men were with him. My history book never told me that the Windy City of Chicago was said to be founded by a black man, Jean-Baptiste de Saussure, or de Saussure. When the British soldiers fired into the crowd in Boston, Massachusetts on March the 5th, 1770, one of the first persons to fall dead was a black man, Crispus Attucks. So from the very beginning of America, black men and black women have paid installments on this nation's freedom through sweat, blood, and tears. We don't have... We don't have to go back to the 1400s or the 1700s to find blacks who have made and are making at this time great contributions to America. Several years ago, the Citizens Chamber of Commerce here in Lufkin presented Dr. Mae Jamison as its keynote speaker. She was the first black female astronaut to go into outer space. General Colin Powell was the first black to serve as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And as we know, his recent tenure as Secretary of State for the United States of America. Now, Condoleezza Rice serves in that same capacity, a black woman. And Tiger Woods has so revolutionized golf until he has everybody watching golf and trying to play golf. I'm trying to play golf. I've even seen my friend, Brother Jansen, trying to hit that golf ball, primarily because of Tiger Woods. My wife even watches golf. And she says one day she's gonna try to hit that golf ball. So we can see that blacks are making contributions in every aspect of American life. And though we as a people have made great strides, there are still miles and miles to go before we realize true equality. And there are forces that are attempting to see that that dream of equality for the black man never be totally realized. But as I take note of such accomplishments that I have just mentioned, I can truly say today that I am black and I am proud. And on today, I have totally turned black. Thank you.
Dr. Rose, you don't remember that I was also part of the program.
Oh, that's right.
And
Mr. Kirkendall was part of this project for me.
I never felt badly about being black, but after you finished that day, I was more proud of being black. Because, today, some of the things you said I was aware of from reading and doing things, and I'm kind of a history buff. I read it, I don't know what I remember, I read it. And that you mentioned this morning, maybe one day it'll get in the textbooks. And whoever writes that textbook will never make any money. Not with that in it.
Probably not.
See?
Because that's probably why it'll never get in.
This is so true, because the truth hurts.
Not in one of the major textbooks anyway, because...
Well, not school textbooks,
not,
anyway.
No, oh no.
But you'll never get a school textbook. Right. Because then you have to change the minds of students who are sitting there listening, and there's doubt in their minds because of what they were told prior to.
Right.
And so those things that you pointed out. But I was very, 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 whatever the word is, when you finished, I didn't know you well. I just, I've been here, I guess, 3, 4, 5 years. I didn't know you well. We were in the same church. I still didn't know you well. But I was very proud of what you had given to the persons and the background of Philemon, and was read right there in the Bible. And we read the Bible, but we don't remember certain things. It's still there, too.
It's still there, but we don't understand certain things.
Right, and we can read it now. We may not see the same thing you said.
You're right.
I just wanted to make the statement. That's
well, thank you very much. You're very kind to say that. I have a good friend. She comes around Beaumont, Orange, that area originally. Would you run in Orange or Beaumont?
Houston anyway.
I have a good friend in Nacogdoches who is married to a young lady that comes from the Beaumont, Texas City area, and she could not quite relate to a lot of the things that I was saying. For some reason or the other, I guess segregation was not as harsh.
It was worse.
Was it worse?
It was worse. Beaumont, Port Arthur. All down there,
right.
It was worse. Living in Galveston, I refused to go to Beaumont.
Maybe she's in denial, but for some reason, she couldn't relate to I was going through the back door. Why?
Oh, come on, they had a race ride in Beaumont in 1940-something.
Yeah.
So I don't know where she was. I don't know where she was then.
Back door.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't quite understand where she came from. I kind of asked her, what planet were you living on back then?
It's true. Because she's so close to Louisiana, we know that was horrible.
Right.
Get a ride in the car, you get on the back seat, you didn't ask any questions.
Yeah.
You're right.
I was.
Dr. Rose, one thing I would like to say, and I enjoyed your speech very much. When I was growing up, when we were growing up, we were referred to as Negro.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when I moved to Lufkin, I understand that a lot of people didn't decide to call it Negro. And so we didn't like that, and they changed the identification to black.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a hard time relating to being called black. I mean, I my mother always, when we had to write, your ethnicity, she always had us write American Negro. And it wasn't until one of my professors, Dr. Bullock at Texas Southern, who is now deceased, But he was saying, he said black, and then I finally accepted it. But I just refused to accept being called black or being referred to as black.
I would say prior to 19, I'm not sure I can pin the year, prior to 1964, maybe prior to 1954. If you call a Negro black,
right,
you had a fight on your hands.
That's right.
And one of the worst things you could say to the Negro, could say to the Negro, you old black thing, and you're fixing to go to Fifth City. Don't call me black. You're right. I had difficulty accepting that because of just what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. We had been convinced that black was bad, so don't call me black.
But do you think that act of changing that termination, the terminology to black, helped you to accept
my blackness? Black. Yes, it did. It did.
Well, more positive things began to happen for you.
Yeah. And so black began to be looked upon as a positive, as a plus. Yes, that helped.
If I may, first of all, I enjoyed your speech too.
Thank you.
And secondly, I was working on my master's at SFA. My professor at A&M said, I want you to go ahead and graduate. Mm-hmm. And I want you to go to SFA and get you a sociology course. I don't care what it is. So I went over there. And the head of the department said, we got one open class. And he told me the name of the professor. Mr. Cross had a lot of problems with him. He says that he pretends now, if you can stand it, he said, because he's going to probably get after you, mm-hmm. that he cannot say Negro. Mm-hmm. He says Negro.
Negro?
Well, one day in class, he did say that.
Is it Dr. Wade?
Dr. Wade, M.B.
Oh,
Wade.
Oh, no, okay.
And I said, the black terminology had come into play, and he asked me a question. We were talking about multicultural problems, and he said, what about the Negro? And then he said, Negro. I said, well, Dr. Wade, I said, the black people in America, and I went on to expound. Mm-hmm. And after that, he started saying black.
Yeah.
And I had to get a resource person, and guess who I got?
Him?
Mr. Cross.
Oh.
To go come in and speak.
Come in and speak to him? Mm. I've had one person that used the term Negro that I think sincerely thought he was using the right pronunciation. Because when I told him it was offensive, he cried.
Is that right?
He cried. Dr.
Yeah.
Payne.
Is
Dr.
that right?
He said his mother had taught them all of that. Don't refer to colored folks as niggers.
That's
don't
right.
do that. How would you like to be called? She said, call them niggers. They are not niggers, they are niggers. And he had been taught that that was the appropriate way to pronounce it. And he was sincere. Mm-hmm. But now these others, especially one that was here in Lufkin, he knew better.
Mm-hmm.
he intentionally, mm-hmm. our little Negro children, mm-hmm. our Negro teachers,
mm-hmm.
he intentionally. And when he suggested that I find some way else to work, he said Stephen F. Austin should be ready for a Negro professor.
No.
Yes, he did. He said, would you mind my calling? Excuse me, but I
saw
her
hand. I'm sorry, too, yeah.
And I think I saw his hand a long time ago.
Yeah. Now, can you tell me at what time period in your life you identified with the African nation? The reason I'm asking that question, I was reading a book by Schlesinger,
mm-hmm.
and Schlesinger maintained that in the Kennedy administration, they approached the African-American community and with the term African-American, and the African-American community rejected that term.
I'm pretty sure
they did not want to be identified with the African nations at that time.
We knew nothing
about
the African nation. We knew nothing. We had the same textbook you were getting after you had torn them up. We got them.
That's right.
And I'm sincere.
That's right. Exactly.
We didn't get a new book in Dunbar in the school. I never had a new book in my hand as a high school, as a public school student. Never.
We didn't get them where I went to high school.
We got them when they went out of adoption, when they got tore up over the whites, they sent them over to the,
so
I'm not going to use that term, but we got them.
That made us always be five,
be
six, 7 years
behind.
That's right.
We knew nothing about the African nation.
That's right.
How could we identify with them in a positive kind? We didn't know about them. Yes.
Dr. Rose, I hope I'm understanding things since I was running late, and I apologize for that, but I heard so much about the speech. I wanted to be here at the year then, and I missed it again. But anyhow, I just wanted to elaborate on something that Mr. Kirkendall had mentioned, and I got in with him with that. And And Mr. Kirkendall, y'all were talking about you and Dr. Rose. Y'all were talking about going to the back door. I'm from Arkansas. And I don't know how old the young lady was that was talking about that she hadn't witnessed or went through that.
Older than I am.
Okay, but let me tell you, but let me tell you what my experience has been when I lived in Arkansas. And I remember hearing people talk about going to the back door while I lived in Arkansas coming up. And I must have been, I was a teenager for sure. I can't remember from the time that I lived in Arkansas ever going to a back door, having to go to a back door. Now, and as I thought about that and was talking to my relatives about it, because a few of them remembered that, I think a lot of it has to do with age. And another thing, a lot of it has to do with also conception, those things that we noticed. After my mother explained to me the reason why I didn't see that, it's because she didn't send me on errands. You see what I mean? And that's why I was thinking maybe the young lady did, because it was very well there. I just didn't experience it. It was going on. I just was not a partaker in it because she did all of our running around, and she was a, you know, she was a homemaker. So it was my older sister that was, you know, like 10 or 12 years older than me that had to do the errands and that experienced that because I didn't. That went to the downtown businesses and know, you know, and they named the place this one. One cafe, it was a restaurant that everybody liked their chili there at this restaurant. Well, we got chili there all the time, and my mother, you know, from time to time was a cook there. I never knew that they had to go to the back door.
That's right.
Because, see, I never went there. It was always brought home to me, So, and just getting in on that part that Mr. Cantu told me that she was older than you, I didn't either. When people would say things like that, and the people that was around me that was my age, we didn't relate to that either. But it was going on. But the only reason why it was going on at our age, but the reason why we didn't know of it is because we were not partakers of it. We were not able to go downtown to go to those places. We were not of the age that our parents let us do that. So when people talk about different things like that, it wasn't because it wasn't going on, it wasn't happening. We were not partakers in it for a lot of reasons that I mentioned.
Okay.
It was going on.
Were you aware that it was going on?
No.
Oh, you were not?
No, I was not.
Our parents kept it hid from us.
Okay.
What did he say? What did you say?
I said your parents kept it hid from you.
I don't know if they kept it hid from me more so, or
yeah,
you know, my mother,
that's why,
was just,
that's
she was
one
the
of the reasons. I don't know your parents, but I met them. But that's one of the reasons they didn't let their children, especially you at your young age, go out into the community, because in my, I was born and raised in Karnak, Texas. Lady Bird Johnson's dad and grew up under him. And nicer person you want to meet when it came to the way he treated you, but then you had to abide by some of those black laws that they had set up.
Yeah.
And one of them was, if you went to the front door, run the doorbell, or put your knuckles on the door facing, the lady of the house would come and raise up the little flap and see who you were, said, oh, you got to go around to the back door. And that was just that. My daddy and I did some work clearing out a fence row and stuff. They gave us our dinner. What did they give it to us? Out of the back door, and we sit out on a little bench on the shade tree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Yeah.
So they just kind of kept you. They probably didn't want you to know this, maybe.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. But she.
But it was happening.
But she, my mother, explained it to me as a such that I didn't know about it. I just didn't know about it because I was the one, I was always at home. I was the youngest of my family.
Well, it's quite possible this lady did not experience this herself, but I guess I presume that she should have known it was going on. Maybe she didn't even have the opportunity to encounter anybody that was working. Because her dad worked for Amoco Oil, and they were considering, in those, well, even not, they were one of the wealthier blacks, you might say. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they were kind of the upper crust. So it's very possible that she never encountered those kinds of things. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you know what? Because it just was never brought to my attention. I never thought about it. And I can remember when they immigrated to school in Arkansas, and I thought it was interesting talking to a lot of people in Lufkin and even in Dallas, that when they integrated to school, they had a lot of confusion. Mm-hmm. In the town that I lived in, it was a transition that was smooth. That's why I didn't know about a lot of it, you know, because the transition was so smooth, more or less. You know, when we didn't have any fights or anything like that. The only difference is we had a year before to make up our mind to go there on our own to witness it, and I was one of those people that went over there.
You ever heard the name Daisy Bates? Daisy Bates?
You know, some people talk about Arkansas. Arkansas wasn't as bad as Texas and some of the other states. You know, even though Governor Faulkner had his way and all that kind of stuff, but it still wasn't as bad as Texas and some of the other states when it comes to desegregation, segregation.
It wasn't as bad, but remember, we was bumped up. The state of Texas is right there with Memphis, Tennessee. It's right there Arkansas. It's right in between those areas, Texas and, you know. But remember, Martin Luther King did a big march and everything down there where we were. But I'm just saying, at that time, you know, before this Martin Luther King, and all this came up before Dr. King did his march and all that, you know, in Little Rock and all that. But it was just so...
What year was Central High forcibly required to integrate in Arkansas? That was under Dwight Eisenhower's tenure as president. In the early 50s, so Arkansas early on had encounter with this. And that sort of put them in the forefront of this thing.
That's
and Texas dragged and dragged and kicked and cried till the very last. And Lufkin, after Texas said, okay, we got to do it, you show it. And Lufkin still said, we're not going to do it. We're not going to offer an acceptable. And this was the position that the school board took, I think, at the time. I don't know whether he was on the board at that time. But it came out in the paper that they decided, if you want us to present an acceptable desegregation plan, write it for us. We don't intend to prepare one that would be acceptable to the Justice Department.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Rhodes.
And so the Justice Department wrote it for me. And we stayed on it for 30 years.
That's right.
Remember the number of private schools that opened up in Lufkin?
Private schools started popping up all over the territory.
Church, private schools.
Homeschooling.
And unfortunately, church schools opened up not to teach Jesus Christ.
No. Just to keep you out of...
They opened up to keep them black folks out of here.
Yeah.
Now, let's tell it like it is.
Yeah.
It wasn't to teach the gospel. It was to teach us how to keep them folks away from us. Say, amen. I saw his hand back.
Amen.
No, in Camden, Arkansas,
Camden.
I went to college in Magnolia. That's where I went.
Yes,
yeah, Otis, how did your community view segregation at the time it was coming back?
Well, when you are born into a condition and you don't know any other kind of way, you learn to cope with it in that way, and you kind of assume this is just the way it's supposed to be. You didn't like it, and I didn't like going to the back doors. I didn't like being called those ugly. I didn't like not having these opportunities. I didn't like it. But somehow or another, you just learn to cope with it because this is the way it is. I guess this is the way it's supposed to be. I don't know why it's like this. I didn't view it as harshly and with as much hostility, I guess you could say, as I do now. Because I was born into it, I didn't know any other way. Probably kind of like folks in Iraq. I suspect they have missed freedom and liberty because they don't know what it is. And when I was a little boy, I didn't miss integration. I didn't know what it was. It's something I hadn't had. So I just wanted to make the best life with what I had right there. And we had biscuits and sakes and some hot bones and milk.
Butter.
And butter.
I'm satisfied. This is all I had.
Phone kill me.
Yeah.
I was going to say, in line with what you said, I worked with my father growing up, and we had an African-American man working for us. And my mom and my family would treat him better, differently than the dominant culture was treating African-Americans at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But he had been browbeaten, and he would resist that. He would not want to do that, I guess because it was not safe. For other people, how other people might perceive that.
Mm-hmm.
So that probably was true. That was true for him. It probably was true for others. And breaking out of that would be very, very difficult.
When you call Akatomi, you know,
if you
play in Akatomi, that's when you sort of play it up to the white man so that you could get some favors from it. And the black folk, well, Akatomi, yes, sir, yes, yes.
Right.
But he knew. Pardon? He was kind of an isolated. But he probably got along so far as his status, so far as little money in his pocket, and fairly decent house, probably did better than most of them because he played the game on the top. You play up to the white man, scratch your head and bow to him, and you know, keep don't stand me now, look down on the ground, play pitiful, and
right.
He'll give you
right.
A crumb, you know. And so, but I discovered when I got into the integrated work, all of us play on the top to a certain extent. It's not based on necessarily race, it's based on who got the money.
Money.
I need your money, man.
I don't think he was doing that.
He
I
wasn't?
Really don't.
Well, he might not have had
he
to.
He and my father went very, very long way back, and he was very loyal to my
well,
family.
Now, that
It was not an effective thing. It was real. Because it came out on other occasions where he defended my father.
Yeah.
With other people. So I don't think
that relationship developed back during the slavery time between
yeah.
blacks and whites. That was genuine.
Yeah.
I mean, genuine love developed between
yeah.
some of those people. So that happened. I can recall there was one, and I picked cotton all over East Texas. And as see before now, when we got ready to eat, you had to get up there in the tree, or you go to the back door, and we had some of these peas that got bugs in them and all that. Y'all can eat that. But I was going to throw them away anyhow. But there was one family, and they were on Highway 21 West, and I got to find out who it was. They had a screened-in back porch. They would always let those cotton pickers come in and eat on the screened porch with the open, cool breeze blowing. And that's the only white person I could ever recall allowing us to come into his house virtually and feed them. The rest of them, you had to be out on the tree or on the wagon or wherever, but not in my house. But that one, I don't know what his name, but I know he's dead because...
Yeah.
But I'd like to find out who that family was, and I want to commend them for at that time bringing those black field hands into their screened-off back porch and feeding them decent food, good same food they was eating.
Okay. Let me ask you a question about the song that you brought up. I'm black and I'm proud.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the impetus for the Black is Beautiful movement, or was it in did it? Just, was it the crystallization?
That was at the beginning when blacks first began to feel proud of themselves.
Okay.
When the Afro started. Lord, I wish I had that Afro today. It used to be we were ashamed of that old head, just like
keep,
I said.
Keep the sun out.
Keep that sun out.
And I cut all mine off.
But when James Brown came out, and I'm black and I'm proud, folks started letting that hair grow as big as you can. Well, we ain't ashamed of this hair no more. Let it go.
Right, right, right.
And so that was
I'm
at the beginning.
I'm just trying to find out which it is.
That was at the beginning.
The result or if it was the beginning or whatever.
Black and I'm Pride came out at the beginning of this Black
okay.
Prideful movement, I would say. I saw it. Yes?
Remember, it wasn't Black and Proud. It was Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud.
That's right. That's right. He said,
so
Say It Loud.
Say
I'm Black.
Say It Loud came out very emphatically.
That's right.
He said it.
You're right. Say it loud. I'm black because we used to. I'm black. I'm proud. No, say it loud.
I'm black and I'm proud.
Say it loud. I'm black and I'm proud. Be it. Say it to me.
But you see, a lot of the young ones now, they didn't see any of these things that you're talking about.
You're right.
So they don't relate to it like she did see it in Arkansas. And it's just like a lot of young folks now, they don't even believe the Holocaust thing happened in
World
War II.
You're right.
Betty Kennedy and I were talking another, we're talking about how can we educate our young kids as to what struggles their forefathers and foremamas have gone through to try to get them where they can enjoy the opportunity. How can we get it? And we're talking about starting some classes and requiring them to come so we can teach them. And the good book said, teach your children.
And that's every race.
Teach it, that's right. All of us need to. Well, it'll be good.
We got one teacher at Lufkin High School that pushed the issue. And I'll be honest with you, I'm kind of a little bit surprised he's still teaching out there because of that. Trying to teach a black history course and never got enough students to register to make the class. Mm-hmm. So he went down to Long Chapel Church and taught it a couple of summers. And the kids said they actually learned a lot about their heritage because it's not in the textbook. It's not talked about in the classroom. And of course, going back to, he was talking about our kids, being a substitute teacher at Lufkin High School and been serving for 12 years, those kids that still, those white kids that still hold some things against the blacks is because of the fact they're being taught. They're being taught. See, a long time ago, back down through yonder, Dr. Rhodes didn't have this, that white kids were taught that black folks had tails. And they'd run around behind them to see, what are your tail at? You know, I'm serious.
Yeah.
Because they said we were kin to monkeys and apes and all those kinds of things.